Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Toyota Reliability, a legend on the ropes.
Everything keeps going right. Toyota!
80% of Toyotas are still on the road today.
Toyota.
Reliability. To move you forward.
Can a company grow too big to succeed? With a recall and a face-off with the U.S. Transportation Secretary, the biggest car company in the world may be looking for some cover.
You asked for it.
You got it. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, February 4th, and The Takeaway is how quickly an advertising slogan can become ironic in a crisis like this for Toyota.
And how quickly a reputation that spans decades can completely fall apart. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning, and Toyota is the top. A few hours ago, the company announced design problems with the anti-lock brake system in the new Prius. This after nearly 140 complaints in the United States, mostly from drivers who say they temporarily lost brake power after driving over a pothole or ice. As for the recall, yesterday U.S. investigators said they'll look at more than just faulty gas pedals. Safety researcher Sean Kane says the sudden acceleration problem strikes him as an electronic issue, not a mechanical one.
In fact, I would even go out and to say that there is no other explanation for many of the complaints that we have seen other than electronics.
Toyota stock has plummeted 22% since the recall was announced.
And this Toyota story is something we really need to revisit hourly. It's developing so rapidly. Paul Eisenstein joins us once again, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. And, you know, you're really seeing in the news out this morning just how much this is rocking Toyota's basic business. Paul?
I've been getting a lot of emails this morning from Prius owners who are just shocked. I don't think anybody expected that this was a company that built its reputation on the cornerstones of quality, reliability, safety, and most important of all, trust. And now that they're admitting that they knew about and were even fixing a problem with the Prius while they were not even acknowledging there was an issue in public, seems to rock that foundation and could destroy their reputation.
Does it erase the profit news that's out this morning?
Well, it certainly comes as a sharp contrast to the profit news. You know, they were originally expecting a loss this year. Suddenly they're saying that they made money in the most recent quarter and will for the year. But let's put it this way, they're going to go into the new year with some serious economic problems because the recalls already out there are very costly, a couple $1 billion at least.
Indeed. Paul Eisenstein, thanks much, from the Detroit.com, talking about how a $1.7 billion quarterly profit potentially erased by all these headlines.
President Obama tried to rally his party at a Democratic retreat yesterday.
So as we think about moving forward, I hope we don't lose sight of why we're here. We've got to finish the job on health care.
There's new meaning to that particular urge this morning. A new report shows healthcare spending grew to a record 17% of the U.S. economy last year. That's the largest one-year jump on record. Overall, almost $2.5 trillion federal dollars were spent on healthcare in 2009. Moving overseas, intelligence officials now say the leader of the Pakistani Taliban was killed in a missile attack last month. He's responsible for a wave of suicide bombings, including the attack on the CIA base there. Earlier on the show, we spoke to Marvin Weinbaum, a former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan.
This is certainly a difficult time for the Taliban, but they are so entrenched that I certainly wouldn't think that with the death of any one or more people that the movement is entirely back on its heels.
The death of the Pakistani Taliban leader is not yet confirmed.
Toyota's moving the markets this morning. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are way down. The Dow gets underway at 10,270. The S&P opens at 1,097. And the NASDAQ starts at 2190. Google, how do we use it? And what's it doing to our brain? That's our tech segment later on today.
And later today, the Tea Party Convention is kicking off in Nebraska. They hope to start a third political party. If you were starting a new political party, what would you call it? And what would your platform be? That's what we're asking you today. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
House party.
That's what you'd call it?
Yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Toyota, biggest car company in the world, certainly one of the most successful brands in the world, which is why the slogans over the years of Toyota's advertising campaigns come quickly to mind. Moving Forward, their current one. But they all have an ironic twist right now. You asked for it.
What
you
a
got
feeling.
It. Toyota, what a feeling. Driving excitement.
Right.
All of these very well-known slogans now add to the brand problems that are associated with Toyota's mechanical problems. There were the accelerator pedals. Paul Eisenstein just referred to confirmation that there are perhaps design problems with Prius brakes. Toyota officials estimated the total cost of the global recall that they're currently in the middle of, $2 billion, the loss of 100,000 vehicles in sales in the United States and Europe. All this has erased a profit reported today of $1.7 billion. We want to explore the sort of brand problems going forward for this very venerable and troubled company with Jeffrey Leiker, who's a professor at the University of Michigan's College of Engineering and co-author of The Toyota Way. And we should remind people that all of the problems referred to in the recall, you have a minuscule chance of experiencing. But when you're as big as Toyota, they are statistically significant. And Ken Benziger joins us. He's a reporter at the Los Angeles Times, co-author of a series of investigative reports on Toyota's runaway cases and some other safety issues. Jeffrey and Ken, good morning.
Good morning.
Ken, let's begin with you. Is there a sense, and I think some of your reporting suggests that that may be the case, that what we've already seen is the tip of something maybe a little bit bigger?
Yeah, there are a lot of issues out there that I haven't answered specifically about the runaway acceleration issue or what some call unintended or sudden acceleration. And there's some questions that have to be answered about how long Toyota has known about this and how they've responded to it, because it could go back as far at least to 2001, maybe 1999. There's also bigger questions about how Toyota handles safety questions in general, even in systems that have nothing to do with this.
And this is something that Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood expressed explicitly yesterday, saying that Toyota needed to be pressured to enter this recall. He had this advice yesterday.
My advice is, if anybody owns one of these vehicles, stop driving it, take it to the Toyota dealer, because they believe they have the fix for it.
Of course, then he backed off from that. But the continuing statements from the Transportation Secretary can't make people at Toyota HQ happy. Jeffrey Leiker, professor at the University of Michigan, what is a company to do in this media onslaught?
Well, the first thing they have to do is fix the problem. And that's what they're focusing on. There's what, about 4 or 5 million cars to recall, and that physically means getting them in, getting the part in. And that's going to take precedence over talking to the media. I'm not sure what Ray LaHood was trying to accomplish by creating a national panic of people just driving their cars to Toyota and dumping them on the lot. But when people say strange things like that, dangerous things like that, Toyota can't really respond confrontationally to the federal government. So they simply say, thank you for your comment. We think you probably meant this. The issue of...
Let's take a look at that, Jeffrey. I mean, does Ray LaHood, rightly or wrongly, suddenly precipitate a crisis that is not unlike the unsafe at any speed problem that the Corvair had when Ralph Nader went after it? Of course, the personal injury lawsuit that derailed the Ford Pinto. Do these even come close to the category here?
Well, I think an exploding gas tank is just different than a sticky pedal that is slow to return, or carpets that shouldn't be in the car to begin with unattached down. But there's two issues. One is, could Toyota have come forward sooner? Could they have solved the problem sooner? Another is, now, at this point, we know it's a minuscule problem. We know that it doesn't occur in new cars. We know that, at least the issue of the sticky pedal, we know that you can, in almost all cases, use the brake and stop the car. Why would you want millions of people driving their car? If it's unsafe, leave it in your driveway. Why do you want them dumping it at a Toyota dealer? And just creating a mess, logistics mess for everybody. That doesn't make any sense.
Jeffrey Leichert's a professor at the University of Michigan's College of Engineering. He's co-author of The Toyota Way. Ken Benziger, LA Times reporter You know, in your investigative reports on Toyota, is some of what you've reported the consequence of being so big and having to operate in so many countries where so much is subcontracted out, often as a condition of even doing business in those countries, that if you get too big, you can't possibly succeed? Bigness is failure in this business.
Well, I want to respond to that, but first I wanted to clear up a few things that Mr. Leiker suggested. I think we've kind of moved beyond the idea that it's only a pedal or a floor mat issue. One of the reasons that LaHood is talking about this is he's demanding that Toyota discuss other potential causes for this problem. And Toyota itself this morning in Japan admitted, for example, that a brand new car, a 2010 Prius, has a braking problem that they knew about and didn't talk about. They quietly fixed in their assembly line, and so that some 2010 Priuses have this braking problem and some don't. And that reflects a general pattern that we found in our reporting, which is Toyota lots of times, just like any automaker, finds problems. The difference is Toyota quietly fixes them and doesn't tell anybody. And so there are cars out there that have problems they didn't talk about. For example, the Sienna minivan 1 year had a defect they detected. They quietly fixed and walked away, but they left 25,000 cars on the road with that problem and didn't do anything about it for 6 years. And that's a pattern that's kind of troubling. As to the size of Toyota, clearly there's an issue there. They for years gunned to be number one. They finally got it in 2008, but when you get really big, to do that, you have to make some sacrifices. And some people are saying, well, quality was what was sacrificed. You
had
to cut costs, and when you cut costs, quality goes down.
All right. Ken Bensinger is a reporter at the LA Times. Jeffrey Leiker, what do you think? Is Toyota too big to succeed here?
Well, I still think these are specific issues. The Prius is a software glitch and a new piece of software. It's a less than a second delay. It happens when there's a bump in the road. These are still very specific technical issues. So I don't think they're too big to design and build good cars. I also,
although at 60 miles an hour, a second delay is a pretty significant distance.
It's not an insignificant thing. I'm just saying the mistake is could be understood as one mistake and not the result of thousands of people making thousands of mistakes.
All right, Jeffrey Leiker is a professor at the University of Michigan's College of Engineering, co-author of The Toyota Way. We're talking about Toyota's problems this morning. We also heard from Ken Bensinger, a reporter at the LA Times, who's authored a series of investigative reports. Toyota moving forward, maybe not. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the headline stories.
A new government report on health care spending says government programs will pay for a little more than half of all health care in the U.S. by 2012. Overseas, Pakistani officials say they've arrested 35 suspects as part of their investigation into a bombing that killed three American soldiers in northwest Pakistan yesterday. Today, we've also learned the suicide bomber specifically targeted the American troops. The death of the three U.S. soldiers has drawn attention to the U.S. military presence in Pakistan.
The White House wants China to stop artificially weakening its currency. President Obama says that contributes to a trade gap with the U.S.
So the approach that we're taking is to try to get much tougher about enforcement of existing rules, putting constant pressure on China and other countries to open up their markets in reciprocal ways.
China is denying and rejecting the accusation. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, is rejecting Iran's offer to swap three American hikers detained in Tehran for Iranians being held in the U.S. She says Iran should still release the hikers.
They should do so on humanitarian grounds, since the detentions of our citizens is baseless.
Finally, our news team cooked up this story that is possibly a historical milestone. You can decide, all right? Those tiny ketchup packets, one is never enough. You get them when you get to take out food. Heinz has redesigned its ketchup packets. After 40 years, the new design is more like a cup for dipping. It has a tear-off end for squeezing and holds three times as much ketchup. Supersizing little ketchup packets.
Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, conspiracy theories around Goldman Sachs.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
For our news takeouts this morning, we welcome Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen into the studio along with Louise Story from our partner, The New York Times. But we're going to begin in Islamabad, Pakistan, where the Associated Press reports that a senior intelligence official now says the U.S. believes Pakistani Taliban leader Hakimullah Massoud died following a missile attack last month. Mark Dummett from our partner, the BBC, joined us from there a little earlier this morning. Mark, what was the significance? But the question I asked him at that time was the significance of the possible death of Hakimullah Massoud.
Well, if it is true, then this will be quite a major victory, really, for the U.S. And the Pakistani government, which is deeply opposed to this man, because ever since he's been in charge of the Pakistan Taliban, he took over in August last year. He was responsible. He was behind a wave of attacks on Pakistani cities, which killed hundreds of civilians. These reports suggest that he was killed by a U.S. drone strike in the middle of January. But it's got to be said, we haven't had anything official. The government here says that they simply don't know. They have heard these reports, but their agents on the ground can't confirm it. The Taliban have denied these reports. And of course, because of where he's reported to have been killed or where this strike happened, it's in the middle of this tribal belt. The government doesn't have a real presence there. We can't send people in to find out either. So basically, no one yet knows. But these reports do keep on coming out, and they are quite persistent.
Yeah, another drone attack, at least according to the report, in that remote area. Mark Dummett, what do we make this morning of the deaths of three American troops in, apparently, Pakistani territory near the Afghan border? That was reported yesterday as well.
Yeah, well, they weren't combat troops. They were special forces attached to the Frontier Corps, the Pakistani force responsible for security in the tribal areas and along in the northwest frontier, the area close to Afghanistan. They were trainers. They were military trainers. And they were on their way to visit a school which had been previously destroyed by the Taliban, a girls' school, but which had since been rebuilt with funding from USAID. This poses several questions, the fact that they were killed. Firstly, how did the Taliban know that they were in this convoy on the way to the girls' school? How were they targeted? Or was it just a fluke? Was it just chance? I mean, and secondly, it raises all sorts of questions here in Pakistan about what the American forces are doing here, because it's no secret that there are U.S. military trainers here, but it's not widely advertised.
No, and it's a very, very sensitive issue indeed, and we'll watch
controversial.
The fallout from that report as well. Mark Dummett, BBC reporter in Islamabad, Pakistan. Thanks for that.
Let's move on to kind of a mystery, an enigma, with Louise Story, the finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein left a very cryptic message for his employees last week. What did it say?
So their voicemail boxes are lit up. The Goldman Sachs employees go, they answer, and there's Lloyd Blankfein saying, "Performance is the ultimate narrative." Now remember, this is coming at a very important time. It's bonus time. Right around then, all the Goldman Sachs employees found out their bonuses.
Right.
And everyone's wondering, what's his bonus going to be? What's Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman, what's his bonus going to be?
Gosh, I hope it's a really big one.
They posted record profits last year. So if performance is the ultimate narrative, that would mean he'd get a record bonus?
It could mean that. You know, he did get a record bonus in 2007. He got $68 million. And it's a bit hard. It's a bit hard in this environment to imagine something higher than that.
Yeah, it's true, what do people think that performance is the ultimate narrative mean?
That's the question. He'll have to file a Form 4. Mm. The company will have to file something called a Form 4 when they award his stock. And so everyone's on the Securities and Exchange Commission site looking for that Form 4. And I got to tell you, people are so interested, and this wait, because this is later than usual, is taking so long. It's starting to feel like the TMZ of Wall Street bonuses.
Yes.
You know,
everyone wants
to know, what's the number?
If it's a high number, he's going to be really, really depressed because it's going to be a PR problem.
A PR problem,
oh,
Washington.
No, not another 100 million.
Oh,
no.
Poor Lloyd.
Well, he kind of wins and he loses. He gets the cash, but, you know, also the hatred if it's too high.
I think he'll be able to afford the hatred.
Indeed. Affording the hatred. It's all about working in investment banking these days. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, with our final takeout. And we've been profiling Super Bowl players in the Super Bowl 44 coming up this weekend. And it's time to look at those key players who, well, let's just go back to Super Bowl 38 against the Carolina Panthers. Adam Vinatieri of the New England Patriots had to kick a 41-yard field goal.
Snap. Well down. Kick up. Kick is on the way.
Happy ending for Vinatieri, but what about Scott Norwood of the Buffalo Bills in Super Bowl 25, a 47-yard attempt?
Spot in the air. It's got the distance.
So looking ahead, Ibrahim, who's the kicker that's going to have the most pressure this weekend?
You know, I just reacting to the Scott Norwood miss, that was one of the worst moments of my young life. that was a deep stain on my heart. I missed those Buffalo Bills. But this week, we're talking about Garrett Hartley, who's the kicker for the New Orleans Saints.
Right.
They wouldn't be there without Garrett Hartley.
Exactly.
He kicked the game-winning field goal against the Vikings in an NFC Championship game. So he's already stepped into Saints lore. He's a rookie, and it couldn't get any more exciting for him. He had a dream the night before the game that he was going to kick the winning kick. So this is his meteoric rise. He will be known as a legend and a hero if he can kick the game-winning kick against the Colts in the Super Bowl. On the other side, Matt Stover, who took the place of Adam Vinatieri, who now kicks for the Colts,
right,
was injured. Stover came in week five, and he took over. He'll be the oldest man to ever play in the Super Bowl.
Wow.
42 years old with 11 days.
So the oldest man ever to play the Super Bowl is kicking for the Colts, and the rookie kicks for the Saints. There's another great story.
So the question is, do you want, if it's the end of the game and it's down to one kick, do you want the guy who's got the experience and the wisdom, or do you want the energy and the exuberance?
You want the guy with the luck. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks for that. Coming up, another look at Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Gays in the Military.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, it's perhaps not surprising that there's a lot of controversy over the possible repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But is there some real concern behind the controversy? We're going to talk about to someone who says sexual orientation was no secret and no hindrance to him in the Navy. That's coming up. Here's some of the news stories, though, that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Another day, another crisis for Toyota. The company now says there were design problems with the anti-lock brake system in the new Prius, which went on sale last year. As for the recall yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says investigators are looking at more than just gas pedals in Toyotas.
We've had some complaints about the electronics in these automobiles, and that's the reason that we're going to look into it.
Toyota says it expects to lose $2 billion from its largest recall ever. That number will be cushioned a little bit by the news this morning that the company made a $1.7 billion profit last quarter.
Out this hour, India has offered to resume bilateral talks with Pakistan, the first sign of a thaw between the two countries after the Mumbai terrorist attacks over a year ago, blamed on someone who started their operations in Pakistan. In Haiti, the 10 missionaries facing charges for trying to leave the country with undocumented children will appear before a prosecutor, who will then decide whether to press charges. And a life-sized bronze sculpture of a man by Alberto Giacometti has sold at auction for $104 million. It's a famous statue. You may have known it. You may have seen it before, but it is the most expensive work of art ever sold at auction. Judd Tully, editor-at-large for Art Plus Auction magazine, can only imagine who's the buyer.
If you can imagine spending $100 million for an artwork, your net worth has to be somewhere in the several billion dollar category or more.
We're narrowing it down there. The piece was sold to an anonymous bidder by telephone who may or may not be trading this morning. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,270. The S&P opens at 1,097. And the NASDAQ begins at 2190.
Well, President Obama has made it clear that he would like to have Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed, and Admiral Mike Mullen and Defense Secretary Robert Gates are investigating the effects of that. Now, it's a controversial military policy that says gay service members may serve but should not reveal their sexual orientation. So how much would it change in the military if this law were repealed? We're joined now by Michael Hyacinth. He served in the Navy from 1997 to 2005 in a construction battalion, reaching the rank of E5. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Yesterday on the show, we had a retired Colonel David F. Beatty, who is against repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And here's what he had to say.
What most people don't understand is that the military is a pretty cloistered sort of community, kind of like a gated community. It's a lot different than the rest of society. It's much more culturally conservative.
So that's the opinion of a 30-year Army veteran. What do you think? Is the military a lot more conservative than the society at large?
Well, I have to totally disagree with him. I think the military, in regards to the UCMJ, is probably the most diverse community that we actually have in America. So regardless of how he thinks, I think it's totally...
The UCMJ being?
The Uniform Court of Military Justice, which basically guides and governs the structure of the military.
Now he disagreed with any comparison between the racial diversity in the military and diversity which includes sexual orientation. He said those are two completely separate things.
Well, you know, it's funny that we're having this debate now with the this being Black History Month. I totally disagree. I think for American citizens and taxpayers to send citizens to Iraq to possibly die for their freedoms and the liberties that we back here enjoy, and then not have them freely express themselves, I think it's un-American. I think it's something which is long overdue. So I commend Admiral Mullen on his stance on this policy.
Well, I want to play you a clip that we got actually from a listener. This is Anthony from Connecticut. He also served in the military.
When I was at boot camp, they separated the males and the females and put them in their own barracks to avoid any complications of people as young as we were in our sexual prime. How do we train people who are openly gay in the military? At what expense?
What's your reaction to that? That they acknowledge the sexual nature of the attraction between men and women, but if you throw gays into that mix, that it throws that out the window?
Well, I think it's much more than just the two different sexes. I think women have certain needs and men have certain needs, so it's only fitting to actually to fit them in certain locations. But it's a 21st century military, whereas we don't share bathrooms anymore. I mean, basically in Iraq now you have a particular communal that you would use by yourself. So it's for them to make that argument, it's baseless.
It's curious to me that there are so many scandals associated with the military that have to do with kind of heterosexuality out of control. Tailhook, for instance, in the Air Force. Some of the disturbing pictures from Abu Ghraib were sort of heterosexuality gone horribly wrong. I'm just curious as to why this feels like such a hot button to certain people in the military.
Well, I believe it's more of a social issue. You look at the ranking members within the military, the structure that they've come from, particularly John McCain. This was a particular gentleman who was during the 2006 campaign. He said he would listen to the troops. Now, because I guess he's it's fitting to his party, he's repealing exactly what he said on it. So I think it's a structure. It's a mental ignorance, to be quite honest with you.
Did you serve with soldiers during your time in the Navy? Did you serve with people that you knew were gay, even though it wasn't open?
Absolutely. I mean, it's only you can basically see it. It's right there. But it's a difficult thing, psychologically as well, for these guys to actually do 8 to 10 month deployments in harm's way and then have to come back home on a regular military base and hide who they really are. So psychologically, I think we're definitely we're doing an injustice and in-service to these members.
But did you have people in your company maybe that felt awkward about it, that were troubled over the inclusion of gay servicemen and women?
Well, yes, I think it's and I think that's probably going to be the biggest issue is to reintegrate the mental capacity of actually allowing these young soldiers to accept the fact that they are men and women who proudly serve their country that are bisexual. I think that's probably going to be the biggest obstacle.
I want to play you another clip from retired Colonel David F. Beatty, in which he kind of talks about a slippery slope.
We think, some of us believe, that the next step will be a move to extend full rights to same-sex couples. The military provides an easy place to make that happen. And what many of us think may be the consequence of that is the introduction of same-sex couples in military family housing areas.
So do you also have worries about how complicated this could become should they repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that it will end up having a domino effect?
Well, I do believe it's going to have its logistical issues. I think, you look at a ban which has been in existence for over close to two decades. It's going to have some issues. But I think it's something that the United States military, have the leadership capabilities to actually put in structure a method that benefits, every American soldier. Like I said, the UCMJ in particular. I mean, you read the UCMJ, it prevents any inappropriate, misconduct.
But we have had issues between men and female service members serving overseas.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, we're at the end of the day, we're all human, individuals, and no one is perfect. But I do believe that if any nation can create a structure where Americans can serve freely and proudly together, I do believe it is the United States military.
Michael Hyacinth served in the Navy from 1997 to 2005. He's the founder of Urban Liberty, an e-commerce marketing company that caters to the military. Come in, talk about Google, not only how we use it to search for things, but how it possibly changes our brains. And we're just getting news out that the new jobless claims report is out. They rose unexpectedly to 480,000 as layoffs continue.
Listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, some comments about Google from someone who used Google and our obsession with it to make us all laugh. We're going to give Roz Chast, the New Yorker cartoonist, a brain scan on The Takeaway in just a moment. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 48, coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. Fresh economic numbers just in. Jobless claims, new jobless claims, rose unexpectedly by 8,000 to 480,000 total as layoffs continue and jobs remain scarce. This is the fourth increase in the past 5 weeks, and it's likely to move the markets. Futures are down. Toyota stock continues to take a beating following snowballing problems with quality. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says the government is now looking at more than just Toyota's planned fix for those faulty gas pedals.
It's up to us to tell them if we think that their solution is not correct, and now we'll be doing investigations and studying the electronic part of it.
Earlier this morning, the automaker admitted to design problems with brakes on the Prius hybrid. NATO says it draws the line at bribery in the effort to convince Taliban fighters to support the Afghan government, a commentary on the reintegration program. NATO's Secretary General has dismissed concerns that bribes are part of the latest plan to end the insurgency. In tech news, the National Security Agency is expected to help Google analyze a major hacker attack that originated in China. They'll work together to find a way to defend Google from future attacks.
Now a daily look at international business. China has rebuked President Obama after comments the president made yesterday, alleging that the country artificially devalues its currency, giving it an unfair exchange rate against the dollar. Here's what the president said.
If we have established agreements in which both sides are supposed to open up their markets, we do so, and then the other side is imposing a whole set of non-tariff barriers in place. That's a problem, and it has to be squarely confronted.
BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg joined us earlier this morning from Shanghai. He told us how China reacted to President Obama's comments.
Well, the reaction came from the foreign ministry spokesman, who insisted that the Chinese currency was valued at the correct level. He also said that wrongful accusations and pressure would not help solve the problems, the trade spats between the two countries.
Is there proof that China is devaluing its currency on purpose?
Well, there's certainly a lot of complaints about it from economists both in America and, of course, in Europe as well. The complaint goes like this, really. Basically, the Chinese economy has recovered earlier and stronger than almost anywhere else in the world, and yet the yuan is pegged to the dollar, a weakening currency. So what the economists say is, how can it be that when your economy is stronger than anyone else's, your currency is weaker. It doesn't make sense.
BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg, he joined us earlier this morning from Shanghai. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Our tech segment this Thursday involves a cartoon. Yes, it's an old technology, but the ideas in Roz Chast's cartoon in The New Yorker a few weeks back, envisioning a Google magazine, it seems to me says it all about what Google has done to all of us. It's my pleasure to welcome Roz Chast to The Takeaway. Good morning, Roz.
Yes, good morning.
New Yorker cartoonist. You've been doing that for how long?
About 30 years.
Wow. And Gary Small also joins us. He's the author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. That's a very scary title, Gary Small.
Well, I don't mean to make you frightened. Maybe make you think a little bit offline.
Well, certainly this cartoon that you came up with a few weeks back, Roz Chast, made me think. And I urge people to go to our website where they can actually find it. But I'll just sort of sketch it out verbally here. Google Magazine, all right, that's what it says across the top. And the articles are descriptions of what we might call searches on Google. Instead of, you know, 10 ways to make your husband happy, the articles are Capital Nebraska, what? Paella, how to quick? And I'll give you one more, bioethyl merman. I have to say, Roz Chast, I looked at this cartoon, burst out laughing, and said to myself, this totally says it all about what Google has done to my mind, my language, my ability to write. Where'd you come up with this?
I think I spend probably more time online than I should, and it's kind of fun to look stuff up on Google. Sometimes I just like put words together at random and see what comes up, and it's amazing because something almost always does come up. I almost feel sort of shocked when nothing comes up.
And I can look at these, even though they're nonsense in grammatical terms, and know exactly what you're headed for. You want to know what the capital of Nebraska is, so you type in capital Nebraska what. You want to know how to make a quick paella, which is actually quite difficult, and you type in paella how to quick. Gary Small, what's going on in Roz Chast's brain as she's typing these things in, or mine for that matter?
Well, your brain is very active when you're searching online. When I started writing iBrain, I was struck by the fact no one had looked at the brain when it's searching. So we decided to recruit some people who had never been online. And that was probably the hardest part of the study. We couldn't recruit them online, of course. But by word of mouth, we found about a dozen people who had never searched online. And we found that their brains were not as active as those who searched online. But the good news is, after just a week of online searching, there was incredible increase in activity in the front part of the brain, the thinking brain, decision-making brain, and short-term memory brain.
But that seems to contradict the notion that we're all going to end up talking like this Google magazine, where we say, Capital Nebraska, what? We can't really complete a sentence because we'll just sort of Google it, and that we're really relying on Google to do what would have normally taken maybe an afternoon at the library.
The technology is complex, and the brain is complex as well. And so we're seeing a burst of activity once the brain figures out a strategy on how to search. But with time, it becomes routine, and we see less activity, and our brains become more efficient. So just because there's activity doesn't mean we're getting any smarter. And in a way, we're developing a staccato quality of thought where we jump from idea to idea, just the way we jump from website to website.
Right. Gary Small, author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. Roz Chast, New Yorker cartoonist. So jumping from thing to thing is actually the perfect description of how the mind of a cartoonist must work, I would think.
Yeah, I think that's pretty true. The attention span of about, you know, a fraction of a second. And, you know, but I also like on the Google search where it says the search, how long it took, and it's 0.00013 seconds. That just kills me. I just love that. But I don't know. I think I'm less optimistic about it making us smarter. I think eventually we're not going to have to remember anything, and we'll just all have these little Google-like chips in our heads. And anytime you want to know anything, you know, how do I make a tuna sandwich? You know, you'll just kind of like Google inside of your head, you know, tuna sandwich, how make, and you know, you won't have to remember how to do it.
It's the way we'll all talk. Like, yeah. We're all visitors to another planet. Gary Small, react. Cheer us up here, really.
It's all good. Don't worry. But you know, what's happening is we're all developing external hard drives as accessories to our biological brains. So, yes, in the future, we may be Googling outside our brains. But how is that different from what goes on now? If we want to search our memory stores, we kind of do an internal Google to find the information. All this is going to do is really accelerate our brain power.
Roz Chast, has Google or the proliferation of digital technology changed the way you work?
Not really. I mean, I still, you know, it changes the subject matter, but for me, it's still about, you know, what's funny and then doing a cartoon about it.
Okay, well, let's make Roz a little uncomfortable on the way out. Gary Small, you're a fan, right?
Oh, big fan.
And there's...
I'm not worthy.
There's nothing about the technology that's going to change Roz Chast's ability to communicate with us, right?
I don't think so. If anything, we want to think about the upside of the technology, that it allows us to communicate with a much wider audience much more quickly. So anything that's human, anything that's artistic, anything that we enjoy today, the technology has a capacity to make it bigger and better if we don't overdo it.
And that would include cartoons in that. And this concludes the squirmy portion of the program. Roz, you're safe now. Roz Chast, thanks so much for being with us. Cartoonist for The New Yorker, has been for decades. She joins us from Connecticut. And Gary Small, author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. You can just Google him. Thanks to both of you.
Later today, the Tea Party Convention is kicking off in Nashville. They hope to start a third political party. And we're asking you, if you were starting a new political party, what would you call it and what would your platform be?
Hey, this is Gilligan Stump in New York City. My party's angle would be to decriminalize the use of marijuana, and I would call my party the Party Party.
What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. That's also where you can give us nominations for who had a good week and who had a bad week, so we can read them all to you tomorrow on Friday.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.